Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. So this session is free and clear of what? Recent developments in 363F and property of the estate disputes. We'll start briefly by introducing our panelists. Christine, if you want to kick us off.
Sure. Christine Devine, law office of my own. And I think I'm going to start with the boring part of the presentation and give a little background. I'm going to hand it off to David Mawinney when I'm done. And then we've got Sherry Dworskin of Brown Rudnick, Kate Nicholson of Nicholson PC, David Mawinney, our Chapter 13 trustee in the Central and Western District. And Andrew, thank you for organizing this and acting as moderator.
Great. So I'll just give a brief roadmap. So we're going to do a general overview of 363 sales. And then we'll start more in depth with our discussion. We can just define free and clear, go even more and define interest, criminal law and limits of interest. And then we're going to go into a recent development, which was a case from Judge Katz, which was in the Worcester Country Club, Acres. And then we'll have a brief discussion. We have some discussion questions, and then we'll open it up to question and answers. So, Christine?
Yeah, back to me, right? I'll start it off with kind of our general overview. As I said, I've kind of got the broad base of the pyramid, and then we'll get a little bit more specific here. But the starting point of bankruptcy sales, as everyone I'm sure knows, is Section 363. So we're going to put aside the fun, free and clear stuff for now. Generally, sales are governed by 363B and C. Section C governs those sales which are in the ordinary course of the debtor's business. Section 363C provides that the debtor may sell property of the estate in the ordinary course of business without notice and a hearing. So from the jump, as long as the debtor is in possession and operating and the court hasn't taken the right away, sales are authorized in the ordinary course. A little more interesting, Section B also authorizes the sale of property of the estate other than in the ordinary course of business. But here, notice and a hearing is required. Of course, the notice requirements, the hearing timing are governed by rules, the federal bankruptcy rules, as well as local rules of the jurisdiction at issue. The form and substance, scope and timing of notice is all both governed by those rules and also case specific and asset specific as well. So I just want to pause here. We're selling property of the estate. And I said that a few times because that term property of the estate is what is referenced in both subsection B and subsection C. So it's worth taking a look, as the slide does, at what is property of the estate. Property of the estate is governed by Section 541, and 541A1 provides that property of the estate includes all legal and equitable interests of the debtor in property as of the commencement of the case, except as provided in subsections B and C2. So B and C2 exclusions aren't really too relevant for us here today. B is a specific list of exclusions, kind of asset-specific excluded from the estate. One example would be contributions made within a period of time to 529 plans with limits. So there are specific asset type exclusions from property of the estate. And then Section C2 excludes assets which are subject to spendthrift trust provisions. So accounting for exclusions like those in B and those in C2, property of the estate is a broad and comprehensive concept, so the debtor has wide latitude to sell its assets in bankruptcy. Another example, one we've got up there, is that courts interpret property via estate to include contingent and disputed interests. So there, for example, we're talking about potential causes of action that the debtor may have in whatever various state they may be in. Not brought. In any event, those causes of action may be sold through a 363 sale. Another concept to keep in mind as we, you know, talk in more detail about sales is that good faith buyers are protected. There are protections in Section 363M, and a court-approved sale with a 363M finding of good faith cannot be unwound on appeal unless the objecting party obtains a stay of the sale order. So some protection for buyers, some encouragement for sales to allow the free flow of assets efficiently outside of the estate where it makes sense. Provide some finality to a sale order. So far we've talked about sales, just sales of the debtor's interest in its own property. However, 363F allows for this for a sale that impacts the interest of others that they may have in property of the estate. So we can flip to the next slide. Because now we're talking about Section 363F. 363F authorizes a sale under B and C, which I just painstakingly read to you all, free and clear of any interest in such property of an entity other than the estate. So somebody else's interest can be sold here, but only if one of five conditions is met, only one. So I'll just roll through those before I hand it off. So one, if applicable non-bankruptcy law applies, So to the extent that the debtor would have had authority to sell free and clear outside of bankruptcy, that remains inside of bankruptcy as well and can be exercised under Section 1. Subsection 2, if such entity consents, so that's sort of self-explanatory. For example, a lender who will be paid with a lien on assets who will be paid in full at closing may very well consent to the sale. A joint interest holder who will have their interest cashed out at closing may consent to a sale. If the interest is a lien and the sale price exceeds the aggregate value of all liens, again, pretty self-explanatory. If the lien holders can be paid and there's additional equity in the asset, then sale can be authorized under Section 363F3. Number four, kind of interest to us today, if an interest is in bona fide dispute. So I'll give an easy example, and then we'll get to more nuanced examples. But there may be a bona fide dispute as to whether a lien holder has a validly perfected lien in the property to be sold. So that dispute might take time to resolve. And in the meantime, the debtor can seek authority to sell under F4. And preserve the proceeds received for that sale to provide adequate protection to the lien holder, alleged lien holder, whose interest still needs to be resolved. And then finally, Section 5, if the interest holder could be compelled in a legal or equitable proceeding to accept money satisfaction. So if the interest holder could be awarded a judgment under law or equity, then that interest can be converted into a claim against the bankruptcy estate under subsection 5. So, for example, this often eliminates successor liability theories if a sale is authorized under 363F. So with that successor liability potential, now's a good time for me to hand it off to David Mawinney to talk a little bit more about the types of interests that can be disassociated with assets sold under 363F.
Thanks, Christine. So as Christine just said, if the entity can be compelled to accept money, then you can be free and clear of their claim. So there are many cases going back to the 1980s pushing the limits of what you can sell free and clear of. And any of you who have done Chapter 11 work are familiar with the 363 sale of a going concern. And the reason why we champion bankruptcy, right? The reason why we all, certainly in the last 20 to 30 years have said, you know, that bankruptcy is relevant in corporate restructuring is because it's the only place where you can buy a business and cut off success or liability. And there are, you know, scads and scads of cases throughout the circuits that in various fact patterns have affirmed this. And the reason why is because if you go back to the Transworld case from the Third Circuit, certainly wasn't the first to point this out, but it's a well-known version. 363 F4 talks about liens in the sub paragraph. So interests must be more than just liens. Can we go to the next slide? And most recently, during the great financial crisis, during the restructurings of two of the three big three American automakers, the Chrysler decision has a lot of the current mainstream case law on this. Oldco sold to Newco. All of the liabilities stayed with Oldco. And we like this, right? Because if a buyer had to discount for success or liability, they would just discount their cash bid. So doing this creates the most cash you can, and then the creditors can have claims on that cash in the estate. There are limits to this, of course. The Chrysler case is a great example, right? That involved cars. So you could sell free and clear of people who had tort claims for manufacturing defects that were known prior to the sale, but future tort claimants probably are going to be able to reach the successor. So there is a limit, and that all, you know, if you really look at these cases, it really all goes back to due process and fairness. But if any of you remember the Chrysler ignition switch litigation, that really talked about the boundary. And the reason why we wanted to take just a couple minutes to talk about, you know, how far can we push these concepts is when we get to the main focus later, it kind of struggles with the same thing, right? What is the right result? When you read these cases, you just have a feeling that the result is right. By contrast, the other case there, CCX, which is a recent case from last fall in Delaware in the Third Circuit, right? Transworld controls. It wasn't about free and clear of successor liability, but in that case, the new owner rehired all of the union employees and then tried to avoid its requirements under the CBA to negotiate with them. Because, pointed to free and clear, pointed to all the language they put in the sale order. But that didn't work for them because the court, in a well-reasoned opinion, said, look, yes, you can go free and clear of the debtor's conduct and obligations that the debtor created. But the buyer post-sale, if the buyer does things like hire substantially all of the same employees, then under the National Labor Relations Act, they're going to be deemed a successor, not because of the sale, but a successor because of what they did after the sale. And therefore, they could not use 363 to avoid their obligations under the CBA. So I think that's just a nice compliment to see how, again, I read these opinions, and in my view, I think the courts get it right most of the time. But it's interesting to see how they kind of cut and justify and argue within the confines of the statute. So to take this to an even further place, I'm going to turn it over to Sherry.
Thanks, David. So I want to take us away from 363 for a minute. Let's go back to Christine's explanation of property of the estate under 541. Again, property of the estate is all legal and equitable interests of the debtors in property as of the commencement of the case. So we all know, right, that property rights are a bundle of sticks. And some of those property rights are just legal, and some of those property rights are more equitable. And 541D explains that the limit of the court's jurisdiction, right, the limit of property of the estate, really is what the debtor's interest is. So if the debtor's interest is only legal, then the court's jurisdiction and property of the estate doesn't extend to the equitable interests in that property. The other really important piece of the statute I want to point us to before I get into this very thorny dispute is 28 U.S.C. 1334E. And that provides that the bankruptcy court has exclusive jurisdiction of all of the property of the estate, in other words, of all of the property wherever located of the debtor as of the commencement of the case. But that also includes the jurisdiction to determine whether certain property is or is not property of the estate. So in other words, if there's some dispute out there about whether some property is property of the estate, that's into the court's general jurisdiction over all property of the debtors. So I was asked to be part of this panel to talk about a really interesting adversary proceeding that I've been litigating over the past year regarding property of the estate in an area where I never thought I would be, is federal criminal law. So I'm just, you know, operating on the assumption that some of you may also not have a background in federal criminal law, which I did not. And I want to talk about a criminal forfeiture statute, which is 21 U.S.C. 853. And under that statute, the federal government, there are similar state statutes in, I think, every state, but this one is federal. The federal government can seize pre-conviction under certain circumstances or post-conviction, any property from a defendant or from a third party, property that constituting or derived from proceeds that criminal defendant obtained directly or indirectly as the result of the crime. So in other words, if you steal a car and you sell it for money, the United States can come and seize that money from you. They can also seize the car from you. You can also, the United States can also seize it from a third party. So if you steal a car and give it to me, the United States can come and seize that car from me. Now, there is a proceeding under 21 U.S.C. 853N that provides that the criminal court can hear disputes over third-party interests in that property. In other words, if I am a bona fide purchaser for value of that car, the United States has to give it back to me. But any other intervention in this criminal forfeiture proceeding is barred except for 853N. So the criminal code sets up exactly what happens to this property that is subject to forfeiture. In other words, property constituting or derived from proceeds of a crime. Okay. The other piece of this that I want to talk to before I get into my weird case is this relation back doctrine. So when you're thinking about the time at which that interest arises, federal law provides that the United States' interest in that property dates to the moment the crime was committed. Okay, before, in other words, I ever got that car. Once the car was stolen, that's when the United States' interest attaches. Okay, so think about when a criminal defendant becomes a debtor, which happens sometimes. When a crime predates the bankruptcy case, bankruptcy courts hold that assets that are traceable to the crime, okay, so-called tainted assets, do not enter the estate because the debtor had no interest in those assets as of the petition date. Because again, the United States interest dates to the moment the crime was committed. And as Christine has told us, property of the estate only includes the legal and equitable interests of the debtor as of the commencement of the case. So if the crime predates the case, those assets never enter the bankruptcy estate at all. Okay. We represented the Unsecured Creditors Committee of a cryptocurrency exchange called BlockFi. And unfortunately for BlockFi, it housed most of its cryptocurrency assets on the FTX platform. So there, the BlockFi received certain seizure warrants from the United States after FTX had already filed for bankruptcy, seeking to seize all assets from the accounts of two individuals that had been indicted for money laundering. Okay, BlockFi at the time was in the middle of its own crisis because it realized that the assets that it had housed on the FTX exchange could not be gotten or used to pay its own. And so it itself filed for bankruptcy almost immediately. Lo and behold, as the Unsecured Creditors Committee, we find out that the debtors are intending to comply with these seizure warrants and hand over to the Department of Justice cryptocurrency amounting to the entire balance of these accounts. So imagine, right, if I have an account at a bank with $1,000 in it and the Department of Justice serves the bank with a seizure warrant, they get $1,000. That's because banks are solvent. Okay, here we have an insolvent company, and the Department of Justice was seeking to seize assets of the estate that were that belonged to a creditor, right, of the estate. And they were seeking to seize 100% of these assets, even though most creditors at the time were not projected to get 100% recovery. So we thought that violated the automatic stay, and we got a TRO. Minutes after we got the TRO, the Department of Justice filed a motion to compel in their criminal court, which was in the Western District of Washington, compelling BlockFi to turn over these assets, setting up what would have been a massive jurisdictional nightmare. We then got a second TRO, and then you know the criminal judge sat down with the bankruptcy judge in his own district and agreed to back off and let the bankruptcy courts handle it. Now, the Department of Justice's argument was that these crimes that had been committed or allegedly committed by these money launderers predated their deposit of the cryptocurrency in BlockFi, predated BlockFi's bankruptcy. And so these funds left BlockFi's estate, and the bankruptcy court doesn't have jurisdiction over them. And moreover, if the debtors thought that they had an interest in this property, they could, and they thought they were a bona fide purchaser for value, they could go to the criminal court and have a criminal forfeiture proceeding under 853N. Now, we said, hang on a second. BlockFi doesn't have these assets, right? Cryptocurrency is traceable, but frankly, it's not that traceable. And most of these assets were sitting on the FTX platform. They were all commingled under BlockFi's terms of service. We know which cryptocurrency assets were deposited by the defendants and which cryptocurrency assets were deposited by, you know, a grandmother in Topeka. And all we know is that the defendants have a claim, and we're happy for that claim and whatever recovery is going to happen on that claim to go to the Department of Justice, but not 100% of the nominal value of their accounts. And moreover, the bankruptcy court can decide which assets at BlockFi are property of the estate and which are not. In other words, which property properly belonged to these defendants and which did not. So then the Department of Justice, unsurprisingly, files a motion to withdraw the reference, which was denied on the grounds that it's a core proceeding for bankruptcy courts to figure out what is property of the estate and what is not. And then they filed a motion to dismiss, similarly, that the bankruptcy courts don't have jurisdiction over property subject to forfeiture, to which we said, we're not disputing that the criminal court has jurisdiction over assets subject to forfeiture, but it does not have jurisdiction over property estate. And the question is, which is which? And that's a question over which the only the bankruptcy court has jurisdiction. So all of this is now teed up. We filed a motion for summary judgment, and we're starting mediation relatively soon. This has been a really, really interesting and kind of niche issue that deals really with the limits of what interests does a debtor have at the outset of a case, and what is the limit of property of the estate, which is why when I read Judge Katz's decision that Kate is going to talk about next, I was fascinated, and frankly, I thought that George Katz got it exactly right. But I pass it to Kate to tell us all about that case.
Thanks, Sherry. So I'm going to talk about the Worcester Country Club Acres case. The Worcester Country Club Acres case involved a developer who intended to build a age-restricted condominium in Worcester, the Worcester Country Club Acres, and bought the land and submitted it to the condominium and reserved for itself certain development rights. You know, things didn't go exactly according to plan. And the condo wasn't completed at the time that those development rights were going to expire. And so the debtor purported to go through the process of extending those rights with the trustees of the condominium trust and the unit owners, you know, whatever the steps are required under the statute to extend those rights. Fast forward a little while, the unit owners kind of got new counsel and realized maybe those development rights were not properly extended, right? And they brought suit against the debtor in the land court, seeking a determination that the development rights had expired and that basically the undeveloped land, which under the condominium statute, as a matter of law, constituted the common areas of the condominium, was free and clear and belonged to the unit owners rather than the developer. So the developer basically had no right to continue to develop that property. And in fact, that the secured lender was unsecured or did not have a valid lien on the land because it was owned by the unit owners and they didn't grant the mortgage. So the developer did what any reasonable developer would do and filed for bankruptcy. And in the bankruptcy, a Chapter 11 case proposed a plan through which they were going to sell either or both the what they called the reserve land, which was the land, the undeveloped land, and the rights to develop the land. And they were going to sell them free and clear of these claims that they didn't actually own these things, right? So that was the question. Are they able to do that? You have a disputed property interest, right? 363F says that you can sell free and clear of an interest that's in bona fide dispute. They said, great, we'll file bankruptcy. We'll put a plan together. We'll sell the land and the rights free and clear. And we'll give the, you know, the unit owners and the condominium trust a lien on the proceeds. Right? What more can an interest holder want? So the issue was before Judge Katz, and the condominium trust argued you can't do that, right? You can't, filing bankruptcy does not make property that's not yours property of the bankruptcy estate, right? It doesn't augment the bankruptcy estate. You can't sell somebody else's backyard by virtue of filing a bankruptcy. You can't do these things. And the condominium, the developer argued strongly that that's the whole purpose of a 363 sale. When you have these bona fide disputes, you have to be able to move expeditiously. The development rights that were purportedly renewed are going to expire in 2025, right? So if a sale wasn't able to happen before the adjudication of the rights, then the developer would be severely prejudiced because those rights would evaporate through the passage of time, right? So there was definitely urgency on their side to getting some kind of sail through to preserve any value for the developer and the developer's creditors. Which is generally speaking a very compelling argument in the bankruptcy court, right? The value of this asset is diminishing. There's going to be harm to creditors if we're not able to move quickly. And it's an important argument, and it's the kind of thing that bankruptcy is supposed to protect against, right? And so really was pushing up against this limit that Jerry was talking about. Like, what is the edge of these interests that are or are not property of the estate? And how is a bankruptcy court supposed to just like logically or systematically go through the decision-making process of, is this a kind of sale that can be approved? And there are cases on both sides, although I will say, and this is something I wanted to point out, is that there are a lot of cases that talk about how the bankruptcy judge has the authority to authorize a sale free and clear of all kinds of disputed interests. And it's not just liens, and it's not just, you know, it's whatever the property interest is. If there's a bona fide dispute, the statute is clear. But in practice, courts are not authorizing these sales. They're not allowing a debtor to sell IP that it can't prove it owns, right? It's not allowing a debtor to sell consigned goods that when the owners object, right? There's definitely a disconnect in the cases between the language the courts use, which is very broad, and the results that litigants are getting. In the Worcester Country Club Acres case, Judge Katz decided that the debtor could not sell the assets free and clear of the trust disputed interests, and that it was, you know, a threshold issue, a gating question, whether the property is property of the estate. And even if that's going to take time to figure out, even if there's a risk to the value of the assets of the estate or the reported assets of the estate, that is something that needs to be decided first. And, you know, Judge Katz, it's really a statutory construction argument. You know, you look at 363B, you look at 363C, a debtor can sell property of the estate. And then 363F allows it to sell free and clear of an interest of an entity other than the estate, right? So if it's not property of the estate, where is the authority to sell it? And in this case, there was already litigation teed up in the land court, and Judge Katz allowed relief from stay for the litigation to proceed in the land court and basically, you know, said, I can't approve this sale now, right? Come back to me if you do own it, but until then, you can't sell. And in fact, the land court ultimately found that the unit owners owned the land, that it had all been submitted to the condominium, and that the development rights had previously expired. So there weren't any assets, in fact, for the debtor to sell in that case. But it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting, it presents the kind of problem that bankruptcy is supposed to solve, but it doesn't give the answer that bankruptcy likes to give. And that's what I think is kind of interesting about it. That in this case, it was necessary to slow things down and to really make sure that the debtor had a property interest in what it was trying to sell. I do think it's a little bit of a unique situation where the argument was you have zero interest in this property, right? I mean, like we talk about the bundle of sticks, and usually a debtor has at least one stick, right? And I think in that case, the arguments are different. But in this case, it was no, the debtor actually owns absolutely nothing. And that's, it's hard to see how the code could authorize the sale of property that does not belong to the debtor. And Judge Katz says that it doesn't. There are a few other, and that's kind of all I have to say about the Worcester Country Club Acres case, unless anyone has any questions or wants to talk about it. But there were a few other arguments in the case that I thought were interesting that I just wanted to bring up today. And one is something that, I mean, Christine just mentioned briefly in going through 363F, which was, yeah, you can sell it as long as you can adequately protect the interests of the entity that's being sold free and clear of. And that was another argument in this case, is how can you adequately protect the interest of, you know, like a someone who asserts an ownership interest in the property, right? And in this case, it was like someone's backyard, right? Like, how can you sell somebody else's backyard and say, well, we're going to give you the sale proceeds and that will adequately protect you if it turns out you're right? So I think that was another challenge that the debtor wasn't able to overcome in the case. I mean, Judge Katz didn't reach that issue because she decided that, you know, first we needed to determine whether it was property of the estate, but you can imagine a different outcome where the problem is there's no possibility of adequate protection. Right? There's no way to preserve the non-economic interests that the other owner has in this property.
So Kate, can I ask you, in that case, did the debtor offer adequate protection or suggest that adequate protection would be sufficient if it ultimately lost in front of the land court and had already sold the property and merely gave your clients the sale proceeds? So did they offer that first? And then was there any other offer of adequate protection? I'm not creative enough to think of what it would be, but I'm curious.
So the language in the plan was just the very kind of standard boilerplate with, you know, liens and interest attaching to the sale proceeds in the same priority as, you know, currently existing, that kind of thing. So there really wasn't an effort to address the adequate protection part of it. Yeah.
Is there really just a fundamental disconnect or maybe a fundamental weakness in how 363F4 and 541D relate, right? 541D says that an interest of the debtor is property of the estate only to the extent of the interest that the debtor holds. So if a debtor holds legal title, then that legal title is property of the estate, but property of the estate does not extend to any equitable interest in such property that the debtor does not hold. In other words, if Judge Katz is correct, right, and what has to be determined is whether something is or isn't property of the estate, then I'm sympathetic to the view that 363F4 might be meaningless if it's the case that a disputed interest, if it's an equitable interest of the debtor, has to be resolved under 541D before a property can be sold under 363F.
I mean, I think that, you know, I think to say that 363F would be rendered meaningless is like really an overstatement, because there are a lot of other scenarios where you can imagine an interest that isn't, you know, it's not exclusionary. It's not like I have the only interest in this property. Like here we have a zero sum game. Either you own it all or I own it all. It's not how much does each entity own or, you know, that kind of thing. And it's true that it's a bummer for debtors, you know, it's definitely a bummer for debtors because you don't always have the time or the resources to do that litigation, right? You want to get to a settlement maybe, or you want to liquidate the asset and figure it out. I do think that the number of cases in which you would have this kind of very stark zero-sum dispute is pretty small. You know, usually you're talking about other kinds of interests and, you know, a leasehold interest or a, you know, kind of a, some kind of contingent interest, future interest. You know, and to your point, Sherry, about what comes into the estate, you know, the debtor could have sold not free and clear, right? Could have sold the contested interest, right? The disputed interest that they had, could have quit claimed it, and let other parties fight about who really owns it. You know, obviously that depresses the value of the asset considerably. And so debtors don't want to do that. That would have been a permissible way to proceed. So,
I mean, another way of maybe looking at this would be if you had a buyer and the buyer's done their diligence and they realize that there is a bona fide dispute about who's going to convey title, then I would imagine that you are going to see all kinds of weird stuff in the sale order. It's going to say, you know, free and clear of all claims, including the claim of this person who may actually own the property. And then, of course, they're going to have standing to object. So, I mean, I think there are checks and balances. And I think, if anything, yes, maybe this is tough for debtors because, as you say, they may not have the resources to litigate and fend off attacks on their ownership, but they also can't end run the rights of other people. And there are checks and balances, even in bankruptcy, that are going to, I think, give everyone the right to be heard. And if there is in this unique case, if I was advising someone who was going to buy it, I wouldn't even close unless I had a release from this other person. You know, and how are you going to get that without negotiating for it unless you get the bankruptcy court to cut it off? And so I just think pragmatically these issues are going to play out in these situations.
We can all think, I think, of lots of other kinds of interests where a dispute gets priced into the purchase price, right? For example, like we do a lot of IP work. And so I often help my partners in the IP group who have clients who want to buy assets out of somebody else's bankruptcy. And sometimes those assets are subject to infringement claims. It doesn't mean that the purchaser can continue to infringe. You know, that obviously is that's that purchaser's problem. And it's also true that that purchaser isn't going to have successor liability for the debtor's infringement. But if the asset, if the whole business, right, is in question, where the value of the business being sold is in question because of this infringement issue, that's getting priced into the purchase price. And as long as everything is, you know, disclosed in the data room before the sale, and the sale order is clear with respect to who's getting a release and who's not, then, you know, the market can do what the market does. But it's you know, where these rights, as Kate was laying them out, are so fundamental, right? Selling a drug, or, you know, the right to produce a drug that may or may not infringe somebody's patent is very different than selling somebody else's backyard. So, you know, I think these fringe cases that kind of teach us about what 363 means and what 541 means are so interesting. I think the cases that happen more frequently are problems that can be solved with money. David, you're on mute.
Thank you. No, I was just going to say that's like the CCX case that I mentioned, right? The buyer priced in. Well, I'll just rehire everyone, but I won't have the financial obligations of the CBA. Turns out they were wrong. So maybe that wasn't priced properly after the fact, but these are definitely issues that people representing the buyers need to be thinking about, for sure.
Great. If we have a few more minutes, I don't know if anybody has any questions that they wanted to ask. You can put them in the chat, I believe. Noel, is that right?
Yeah, the Q&A tab along the bottom. So any questions, feel free to throw them in there.
I'll just mention one other thing. We made an argument in the alternative in the Worcester Country Club Acres case that the claims that we had against the debtor were not the kinds of claims. It's not the kind of thing that 363F can allow a sale free and clear of, right? So there's a Judge Feeney case that talks about avoiding a Liz pendants. You couldn't avoid a Liz pendants through a 363F sale. And we tried to analogize that, you know, it wasn't, we weren't saying we own the development rights, right? We're saying those development rights don't exist. Like, they do not exist. You can't sell something that doesn't exist. And you can't sell free and clear of our claim that they don't exist, right? That's not a property interest. We're not saying that we have an interest in this property. And likewise for the land, you know, the trust is the entity that has statutory authority to kind of bring these kinds of claims, but it was actually the unit owners who own the land. So as to the trust, like, you couldn't sell free and clear of those, free and clear of those, of those claims. And again, the court didn't reach those arguments, but that's another question, you know, kind of in the CCX vein, like, what are the limits of interest that can be gotten rid of and what aren't?
That's so interesting, because I, when I read that, I thought that there was a real analogy between, you know, that line of argument and the line of argument that the Department of Justice was making in our case, which is, look, if the debtor has an interest in this property, it can go to the, it can go into a criminal forfeiture proceeding if the debtor is a purchaser free and clear, a bona fide purchaser for value, now I'm talking free and clear, of this, these criminal defendants' property, right? It can go and have a criminal forfeiture proceeding. And, you know, of course, that wasn't something that was attractive to us, because we said, look, we don't have an interest in that property, right? That's just, they just have a claim. You can have it, right? But the interest in the debtor's property is interest that all of the creditors share. And, you know, the point of bankruptcy is that all of these creditors don't have to go chase assets all over the country. They get consolidated in bankruptcy court, and they don't have to go into this, you know, into criminal court in the Western District of Washington State to fight about their interests in property that is the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court for the District of New Jersey. But it really, I thought that the reason that I've been litigating this case for a year is that there isn't a meeting of the minds over what property we're talking about and what.
Right. I mean, that's something that's interesting about your case, Sherry, because, I mean, of course, money is fungible, and you put it in a bank or you give it to someone, you know, whatever, it just, like, comes and goes. And so your argument is, well, you know, the criminal's money has gone elsewhere. You'll have to go find that somewhere else. But this money here, this is different money, and we're keeping it, you know, and it's.
Exactly. And that's where this traceability issue becomes so critical, right? And this relation back doctrine only relates to assets that are traceable to a crime. So, for example, there was a case, a bankruptcy case, I now can't remember what it's called, where a trustee, long after a bankruptcy case had ended, a trustee, I think the debtor was a golf course, or maybe the debtor owned a golf course, literally uncovered a box of money in the that had been buried in the golf course. And the Department of Justice seized it, and the debtors brought this to bankruptcy court. They said, the trustee brought it to bankruptcy court. They said, wait a second, the debtor can't trace, the Department of Justice can't trace that box of money. It was cash, that box of cash, to the crime. And because they can't trace it to the crime, it's property of the estate, and we get to figure out what happens to it. The bankruptcy court ruled that that was correct, even though they then later sent it to the criminal court for you know, other reasons. But, you know, this traceability question is really critical to whether something enters the estate or not.
Sure. And
I was going to say, fortunately, in our case, there was no dispute that these assets could not be traced. They just couldn't be. And I frankly don't know enough about crypto to know why, but they were sort of commingled in such a way that they couldn't be traced. Sorry, Kate, I cut you off.
Oh, I was going to ask about the forfeiture. I was thinking about, like, if a debtor files for bankruptcy while the criminal matter is pending, mm-hmm. and a trustee like administers assets, and later there's a conviction, like, does the forfeiture?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, and I'm not going to pretend to be a criminal lawyer, especially while we're being recorded, but the Department of Justice, they can seize assets post-conviction, but under certain circumstances, they can seize those assets pre-conviction. In other words, if they think that those assets are going to be, you know, handed off to someone else, they can kind of seize them, I guess, prophylactically. And so I don't know how that would work, Kate. If I think that the Department of Justice would just seize them, and the trustee could later petition to get them back, they're supposed to get them back. If the criminal defendant is supposed to get them back, if they're not convicted, they may be subject to court fees and all kinds of other stuff. But if a person is convicted, is not convicted of a crime, they're supposed to get their property back. I am told that in practice that is harder than it should be. But in theory, if the criminal defendant is a debtor, would then have the power to get those assets back and distribute them out to creditors.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.